Luke 10:17-10:24 continued. The 49th talk in a series on the Gospel of Luke was presented by Jack Crabtree on October 22, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, Larry read the passage that we looked at last year, and last week. Don't judge this church by the teaching team. And we ended with a question, and I wanted to take the first part of today to respond to that question at some length, and then I want to open it up for any questions that you might have. Then that may take the whole morning. If we have more time, I'll then go on to the next passage. But we're in Luke chapter 10, and we looked at I commented last week on, I was watching Satan fall from heaven like lightning. And just to remind you the context for the question, what I'm proposing is that what Jesus is getting at is that on the spot, right there, whether it's a vision, a metaphor, just a picture, it's difficult to say, but the significance of Satan falling from heaven like lightning, I'm proposing, is that Satan has, up until that point in history, been, in a manner of speaking, ruling from the heavens. And that the heavens is the abode of the gods in pagan thought and Greek thought. And remember, the heavens is a pagan word, not a biblical word. So the biblical authors are just borrowing a concept right out of the ancient world of polytheism. So the abode of the gods is the abode of those beings, those forces, those realities that shape history and shape the course of the lives of ordinary people. That's what a god is. Well, for Satan to be enthroned in the heavens, or he doesn't say enthroned, but for Satan to be in the heavens is suggesting that he's at a place where he rules. He's controlling history. He's controlling the nature and structure of people's lives. So for him to fall from heaven is, I think, a metaphor for him losing that authority. Now, what I proposed last week is as the apostles write their letters, they don't seem to have the perspectives that Satan is no longer active. I mean, they seem to be very well aware that Satan is still at work in the world. So how do we square those two things? You have Jesus saying Satan is falling from the heavens like lightning. You have an image in Revelation that I correlated that with, where Satan is thrown into the abyss and locked in the abyss for 1,000 years, toward the end of time, he will be released from the abyss to go out and deceive the nations, Revelation says. So my proposal would be that we are in that period of 1,000 years, which is not literally 1,000 years. Almost nothing in Revelation is literal. It's, I think, just a number that represents a vast amount of time, a significantly large amount of time. So there's this significantly large amount of time that really began at the time of Jesus and the apostles. And we are still, I would argue, in that 1,000 years. Sometimes it feels like we're coming to the end of that 1,000 years and that the darkness is growing, but it probably felt that way in the Middle Ages as well. My own prediction would be that we either need another Reformation or we're at the end of the time, one or the other, but things can't stay the same. Eventually, the time is going to come where that 1,000 years will end, and when that 1,000 years ends, then we're going to see Satan come into power in a way comparable, perhaps, to the kind of power he had throughout all of ancient history up to the time of Jesus and the apostles. Well, what did that look like? Well, we know what that looked like in the time of Jesus and the apostles. Jesus and the apostles encountered a number of people who were demonized, to give a literal translation of the Greek, who were had some kind of effect of demons in their life that was really causing problems of one kind or another in their lives. They were demonized. And what I suggested is one significant difference between our experience and the experience that Jesus and the disciples encountered is that I have never, ever in my life met a person that I was clear was demonized. And I mentioned I've been to two exorcisms in my life, and I came away from both exorcisms convinced that there wasn't a demon within 50 miles of the place. That it just didn't ring true. It didn't appear to be what Jesus and his disciples encountered. Well, Jesus' disciples are encountering demons, and they're commanding them, and the demons are obeying in this passage. And Jesus tells them, don't rejoice in that, but rejoice that your name is written in the, what is it, written somewhere. But we live in a time, we live in a culture, we live with all kinds of people around us who are reporting to us that lo and behold, you know, maybe not here in our community, but somewhere in the Philippines or somewhere in Africa or somewhere in South America or somewhere in China, there are people that are just casting out demons right and left. And there's this incredible activity of both the supernatural work of demonic powers on the one hand and the supernatural power of God and the Spirit of God confronting them on the other hand. There's all kinds of reports of that. So I think the gist of the question is, with what kind of confidence, really, can I here stand here and say it's not going on? It's not the same as it was in the time of Jesus and the apostles. So that's the question that I want to address, and I want to take a little bit of time to do that. What you often hear are people saying, well, I know that some of those reports are not true. They're exaggerated. They're just false reports one way or the other. But if even a fraction of the number of cases that I hear reported are true, then God is at work and Satan remains at work in the same way that he did before. I mean, even if 10% of those reports are true, then something's going on out there. And that's normally the reasoning and the logic that people use to believe that something's going on. Well, a little philosophy to start with. This is what's been most compelling to me. Those of you who are at the conference, this is a little bit of review. There's a school of philosophy that has been largely ignored in the history of philosophy, but has been very, very influential to me because it just makes so much sense to me. And it's the school of philosophy called Scottish Common Sense Philosophy. There was a Scottish philosopher named Thomas Reid who basically was the engine that drove that school of thought. And I don't know enough about the whole school of thought to know that across the board, it was a good thing. It's Thomas Reid that I've read, and he's the one who has influenced me. Thomas Reid, basically, his position, he's answering the skepticism of the Enlightenment, particularly the skepticism of David Hume, the English or the other Scottish philosopher. And what Reid argues is we come equipped, built by God, with intellectual machinery up here, just call it ordinary human intelligence. We come equipped with this intellectual machinery that prepares us to make contact with the reality out there that God has created. And basically his fundamental vision, which I like a lot, is that God created the world to be able to talk to me through my senses. So when I rub my fingertips across the surface of the stand, for example, I feel the texture of the stand, the stand, and it is what we call rough. The feeling, the sensation in my fingertips is like a language. Reid calls it a natural language. And I know what that feeling means. And because I come equipped knowing that language, my senses give me the ability to let the world speak to me, if you will. Through my senses, it's giving me sense experience that has meaning that I know the meaning of. And in that way, the world speaks to me and tells me about itself. And that's how I gain knowledge of the world. Well, his contention is that knowledge of that natural language is literally built into me. It's built into human intelligence itself. In computer talk, it would be part of the ROM, not the RAM, but part of the ROM of my human intelligence. It's hardwired into me. I don't have to learn it. It's already known by a human being. Okay, he goes on, and he develops his theory further, and he's interested in what do we know about history, for example. And in that context, he brings forth what he says is the principle of credulity, which he argues is likewise foundational, hardwired into, built into the very fabric of human intelligence itself. And the principle of credulity is this principle that our natural, intelligent, rational response to someone telling us that something is so is to believe them. That's just built into us. And he makes the very, very important and compelling point that imagine how little any of us would know if, as infants coming into the world, the principle of credulity were not operative. If babies were skeptical of everything their parents said, you know, good luck. Prove it, Mama. It's just we're not going to know anything. We won't be, and what Reed is really talking about is the communal nature of human knowledge. Human knowledge is not an individualistic task, endeavor. We're able to build on what other people have experienced and come to know and discovered before us. But we couldn't learn from them if we didn't believe them, if we didn't accept what they said as valid knowledge. So the whole community of human knowers can progress precisely because it's a rational thing to do to take human testimony and accept it at face value, on the one hand. On the other hand, we learn from experience. This isn't hardwired in. We have to learn from experience. We learn from experience that there are other factors that go into people telling us what they tell us other than just a straightforward retelling of what they in fact know. We learn that people lie. We learn that people exaggerate. We learn that people even perceive reality different than it was. But all that stuff is stuff that we learn from experience and have to learn over time. Some of you have heard me tell this story before, but I was talking about this stuff in a group one time, and somebody related the story about how a friend of theirs had taught their color spectrum and shifted it. So they taught them that red was orange. I can't do it that fast, but red or violet. That violet was red, and you know, blue was green, and yellow was, I don't know. What an awful thing to do. I mean, lying is such a vicious, vicious thing because it's exploiting us at a very vulnerable point. Namely, we are hardwired to believe. We are hardwired to accept and gain knowledge from the people that are telling me knowledge. If you betray that, you have done an incredibly vicious thing. Well, I don't know how that story comes out, but I'll bet you that child didn't believe in Santa Claus once they found out. You learn in time that people have lied to you or people have misrepresented reality to you. Okay. So what does that mean with respect to all of these reports that we hear about miracles or demons or whatever? Well, on the surface, my knee-jerk reaction to take it at face value and believe it is intelligent. It's rational. It's what we ought to do. It's what we are hardwired to do. We're not being gullible. We're not being stupid. We're not being naive. We're just being intelligent, rational human beings when we hear someone give us a report and we go, okay, if you say so, then. Now, most of us are sophisticated enough to know that if that report on the surface of it doesn't fit into reality the way I understand it, immediately I become critical. I don't know. I mean, we're literally torn, I think. On the one hand, we want to believe because my hard wiring tells me that you should believe. On the other hand, I know that sometimes people say things that aren't true, and this doesn't fit into my worldview, so I find that incredible. And we're literally torn. And most of us just stay in that limbo. I don't know what to do with that, and don't think about it any further. But I want to encourage us to think about that a little bit further. Several things we learn from experience that I think we need to keep in mind that are important to the issue of the supernatural. We learn through experience that people lie and defraud, and even in the context of things like theology and experiences with spirituality. The most striking example for me, when I was in high school, there were two young men in my high school group in my church at First Baptist Church in Salem who saw a UFO and photographed it. And the photograph was in the paper, in the Salem paper. They were investigated by whatever that group is. The blue notebook, what? Blue book, yeah. They're investigated by that, and the status they received is, don't know, maybe. They got a maybe from that reporting agency. Well, I suspected all along, knowing the character of the guys, and it was confirmed several years later that flying saucer was a garbage can lid being thrown across the backyard of their home. I mean, they just flat out defrauded people in that case. It happens. That's the world we live in. People do that. A second thing we have to understand is that people can have an insatiable appetite for attention. And out of that insatiable appetite for attention, people understand that one way to get attention is to make a spectacular report of some kind. Not too long before I came up here to Oregon from California, the head pastor of the church where I was working, where I was on the staff, had an older daughter who was a little, if I could say, a little lost at that point in her life, not quite sure who she was and what she was doing in life and where she should go in life. But ostensibly, as a part of a kind of conversion experience where she was coming back to her faith, she brought the report that she had been visited by an angel. She'd picked up a hitchhiker, and the hitchhiker had presented some message to her and then just vanished out of the backseat after delivering the message. And that report was received pretty well by the church community that I was a part of. I had trouble with it. I just didn't ring true to me. But many people in the church, because of the source and because of what they took to be the significance of that event in her life, were prepared to believe that. Years later, she admitted that she had made the story up. I think in that case, she was desperately in need of some kind of attention of a certain kind, and it was a desperate plea on her part for some attention. An even more striking example of that, I was an intern at a church at First Baptist in Salem, Oregon, way back decades ago, and I was in charge of the college group, of teaching the college group at the church. There was one young woman who was of college age who lived in a nursing home. I mean, she had no family. She was desperately ill with diabetes and other multiple health problems. She had to have her health monitored constantly. But not only did she have all these physical problems, but I have never met a more emotionally needy person in my entire life. She was an emotional black hole, literally. There was no amount of attention that you could give her that even seemed to make a dent in her need and her craving for attention. Well, during that summer, Catherine Kuhlman, that's how long ago this was, if any of you remember or know Catherine Kuhlman. Catherine Kuhlman was, you know, decades ago, one of the leading faith healers in America. Catherine Kuhlman had a crusade in Portland. So some people from her nursing home took her up to this crusade in Portland. And during the crusade, Catherine Kuhlman had a word of knowledge that there was someone up in this part of the Coliseum or wherever that had diabetes, and God was going to cure her or cure that person of their diabetes. Well, she decided that that must be her, and so she decided she'd stop taking her insulin. And the next evening at the crusade, she stood before thousands of people and declared to them, told the story about how God healed her of her diabetes, and she had thrown her insulin away and she was healed. Well, there's thousands of people who have an eyewitness report of tens of thousands of people who heard an eyewitness report of somebody who'd been healed of her diabetes. And not a single one of them was at the hospital several days later when she was in a coma. You know, none of them knew that. God had not healed her. She simply had wanted to believe that God would love her enough and want to do good to her enough that he would heal her. She had an emotional need that she thought God would satisfy, but I think even more than that, an emotional need that tens of thousands of people would focus their attention on her as she stood before that Colosseum and declared herself healed by God. I mean, we have to remember that the temptation when God acts, there's a temptation for us to think that being healed by God is not about God, it's about us. And we can certainly send that message and believe that about ourselves and take that perspective on it and get a great deal of emotional and psychological satisfaction from me, of all the people in the world, from me being the recipient of God's grace. And I think that's what was certainly happening here. What that means is, if we don't know the person giving the report, we are vastly more capable of giving credence to the eyewitness testimony of the person, while at the same time someone who knows them may be less likely to give credence to the report, because we know what makes them tick. We know what they want. We know what they need. We know the temptation that may exist in their life to exaggerate, to say things that aren't quite true, or even to believe things themselves that aren't true. I mean, notice when we are believing the report of other people, we are trusting their rationality as well as our own. Because they may be utterly sincere. They may truly believe what they're telling me, but their report is only as good as their own critical reasoning abilities are with respect to that report. We also need to keep in mind that what people understand of their reality is always interpreted in the context of certain assumptions and expectations and desires that they themselves have. And people will interpret reality and believe things themselves that are dictated by how much it satisfies those assumptions, expectations, and desires. A huge one, I think, is, and we need to make up a really fancy Greek word for this that'll make it more credible, but people have a lust for the outlandish. Mystophilia, maybe. But people have a lust for the outlandish, for the mysterious, for the cryptic, for the hidden. And with respect to those things, intelligent people can become gullible in ways that they would not be gullible with respect to anything else, just because they want the outlandish to be true in a way. I don't know whether it's a kind of escape. Maybe some of you can analyze this for me. But why is that so fascinating to us? But it is. I remember my grandfather had a book that was always kind of out and available when I was a child. And so whenever I went over there, I leafed through it. It was called Lost Mines of the Pacific Northwest. And it was all these stories about gold mines that, you know, these incredible loads of gold that had been discovered and would make somebody fantabulously rich if they could only find them. But lo and behold, they got lost. Well, I was fascinated by that book. The Abominable Snowman, Sasquatch, all of us to a certain extent are fascinated by the stories of Sasquatch sightings or Abominable Snowman sightings. Ghost stories fascinate us. We almost want to believe them because there's just something so inherently intriguing about them. Just listen to Art Bell every night. I mean, there's a whole subculture of people out there who have simply made it their preoccupation to indulge in and immerse themselves in spooky stories of one kind or another. The best Art Bell episode I ever heard was Art Bell had a recording by some Russian scientist who dug a hole deep, deep, deep into the ground in Siberia, and there were sounds of hell. And what's incredible is how he reports this with such a straight face. It's just, he doesn't laugh at all. But what is that? What is that in us that is so intrigued and so fascinated and so attracted to the mysterious, the hidden, the bizarre, the outlandish? But something resonates with us. Another thing that we need to keep in mind is that when people already believe something or are inclined to believe something, they will accept or interpret a report less critically than someone who doesn't already hold that belief. There's a book that came out, I don't remember the name of it, Spirit of Flame or something like that, about probably a matter of decades ago again, but about all the miracles that were occurring. I think it was in Indonesia, and all these miracles that were occurring. Well, I read the book, some other people read the book. The other people who read the book, their response to it was, oh, yeah, okay, all this stuff is happening. I read the book, and my response was, I don't know. I don't know if any of this stuff is happening. Now, why did I respond so differently? Because they were already predisposed to think that the things being reported there were reality. They already accepted that as reality. This was just simply accepted as confirmation of that. I had not made up my mind, or in fact was inclined to think, that that was not reality. And so when someone comes along and makes that report, I'm going to be critical of it. I'm going to be skeptical toward it. I'm not just going to accept, excuse me, I'm not just going to accept it at face value. I'm not blaming the person who accepted it at face value. It was intelligent and rational of them to do so, at least to the extent that their belief in that worldview was rational and intelligent. They believed the supernatural was still at work in the world, so it makes sense for them to accept reports of it that they hear. It makes sense, of course. But it's also rational of me, if I don't already accept that, to be critical of it. We're going to respond differently based on what we already believe. Okay? People with religious beliefs have a tendency to interpret their own experience in a manner that upholds their belief. This is just the corollary of that. Oftentimes, we as Christians will even use the language, you know, God told me to do this. I mean, some of us do. Anyway, God told me to do this, God told me to do that. Well, we don't even mean that God came with an audible voice and spoke to me and I heard the audible voice and it was God. What we mean is a thought popped into my head and I believe enough in God's guidance over my life and I have decided that that particular thought was God's guidance. So it is as if God were speaking to me. That's probably what most of us mean if we use that language at all, which drives non-Christians batty, by the way, because they don't understand all that. They think you heard it with an audible voice. But notice that the way in which we are interpreting our experience is through the lenses of our own theological convictions and our own theological worldview. Nothing wrong with that. Of course that's appropriate. Of course we do that. But notice to someone else listening how misleading that can be and how much it can distort and mischaracterize our report. They don't get it. They don't understand it. I have a note here when I was reading a scripture passage. Going on? We attribute the supernatural to what no one on the basis of common sense would conclude was supernatural, that because of our religious beliefs, we have a tendency to interpret things supernaturally that no one else would. Bertrand Russell wouldn't. No non-Christian, no secularist would. They'll say that's a coincidence. That kind of thing happens. So we have a tendency, for example, when we're talking about healings, to see cancer go into remission, to get over a virus, to get over a headache, any number of things. If someone came and prayed for us, and my cancer goes into remission, or my headache goes away, or the virus goes away, we might have a tendency, some Christians might have a tendency, to say, see, God answered prayer and he healed us. But look at how the non-Christian is going to look at that. Non-Christian looks at that and says, dude, my headaches go away too. And I don't even believe in God. And I didn't pray. And it's crucial to understand how often we impose our worldview on our interpretation of the facts. It doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it so. It's not unreasonable for us to do that on the one hand, but it can distort the truth of what actually transpired. So the principle of credulity can have a strong distorting effect when a testimony is coming to me from person to person, right? When it's been passed on by several people. That can have a very distorting effect. And let me give you two examples of that. Again, when I was in college, I went to a Bible study in Salem of a group. Some of you may even remember them. I think it was Shiloh Ministries when they were first getting going. And they lived in communes and houses and communes. I mean, they were real Jesus freaks. And they had a Bible study at their commune in Salem, and I attended the Bible study. And during the Bible study, somebody made noises in something other than English. And the leader of the study asked if there was an interpretation, and there was no interpretation. And the leader sort of mildly rebuked somebody for making noises that weren't in English when there was no one to interpret, and that was the end of it. That's all that happened. Well, as we were leaving, it was a very interesting experience for me. As we were leaving, I had been studying Greek at that point, so I knew a little bit about Greek. As we were leaving, one of the attendees turned to the other one and said, "It sounded like Greek to me." Well, it didn't even sound remotely like Greek to me. and I knew a little bit about Greek. I mean, it wasn't even close. But this person said, "It sounded like Greek to me." No, and that was it. That's all I heard. Okay. But I started thinking about that. What is that other person going to go home and say? That other person is going to go home and report, "I was at a Bible study last night, and somebody spoke in tongues, and they were speaking in Greek. And somebody who knew Greek was there and understood them." Well, no, they may not even say that. They just said somebody was there and they spoke in Greek. Now, why would they say that? Because they make the very, very reasonable assumption that no one would ever say something sounded like Greek unless they knew Greek, at least were acquainted with Greek well enough to be able to make that assessment. Now, the first person wasn't seeking to defraud anyone. They didn't say they knew Greek. They weren't making such a claim. But do you see how easy it would be to assume that they were making such a claim, even though they were not? So that person is going to go home and say, my son was at a Bible study, and somebody in the middle of the Bible study spoke in Greek, and they didn't know Greek. And then that is going to get reported later as, I knew somebody whose son was at a Bible study, and he knew Greek, and the person spoke who didn't know Greek spoke in perfect Greek. Nobody is seeking to be dishonest. Nobody is seeking to defraud anybody. In fact, everybody is perceiving what's been told to them, taking it at face value, in a very making very reasonable assumptions in how they are characterizing what transpired. But nothing of the sort ever happened. Okay, another example. Back in the days of McKinsey Study Center, we had a resident there who became very fascinated with the Vineyard Movement, if you're familiar with the Vineyard Movement. And there was a while where in the Vineyard Movement they had weekend seminars where every weekend they would have a healing conference or whatever. And so he decided to go to one of their weekend conferences, and I was very interested to know what he saw, what happened there. So the minute he came back from the weekend, we had coffee. All good theology happens over coffee. And so I said, "So, did you see any miracles this weekend?" He said, "Yeah, there were just hundreds of them." Okay. Well, did you see any? Well, I didn't, but my friend did. Okay, we've already gone from there were hundreds of miracles, and I would reasonably assume he would say that only because he saw them, but I decided I need to ask more specific questions. Did you see any? And immediately we've gone to, well, no, I didn't see any miracles, but my friend did. I said, oh, okay, well, what miracle did he see? There was a woman there who did not have any toes on one of her feet, and they prayed for her, and she grew toes on her feet. Okay, now that had my attention. I mean, that's not like getting over a cold. So I said, okay, so what you're telling me is she arrived without toes and she left with toes because somebody prayed for her. Did your friend see the foot without toes to start with? I can't remember exactly how I asked it, but what I was asking is, did your friend actually see the evidence that she was toeless for coming and toed going? Did he actually see that, or did he just hear that was the case? And his response was very revealing to me and very, very instructive, helped me understand a lot. He said, oh, yeah, sure. I mean, he must have. I mean, you see what he's saying? Well, actually, I didn't bother to ask him that. I don't really know, but isn't it a reasonable assumption that he wouldn't have told me that the miracle happened if he hadn't seen it? Well, actually, no, it's not a reasonable assumption in our world, in this day and age, given the dynamics of what's going on. But you can understand why it would seem to be a reasonable assumption. That we just were willing to grant people that they wouldn't have accepted the testimony except on a firm, rational foundation. But not everyone does, because not everyone is as skeptical and critical as we are, because some people already believe that worldview anyway. And because they already believe that worldview anyway, they're not going to be critical in the way that my own rationality demands in order to be persuaded to change worldviews. Okay, so what should we do with reports of the supernatural today? Is it valid that if even 10% or 5% of all those things that we hear are true, then there must be something going on? I don't think so. Because it's easy enough to see, when we understand the dynamics of how all this stuff works, it's easy enough to see that even if there's 10,000 reports, all 10,000 of them may be wrong, may be false. There's so many ways that those reports can be misrepresenting the facts. Notice something. I mean, pay attention to this and ask yourself this. We're surrounded by people in charismatic churches. And I kind of make a habit of asking them, have you personally seen or experienced any supernatural work? And to date, the answer I've always got is, well, not personally. I mean, isn't that astonishing? It's supposed to be happening all around us, and there's all these churches that are based on the fact and the reality of this thing happening around us, and there are people who say, well, yeah, you know, it's happening all around me at my church, but I just personally haven't experienced it. But all kinds of other people in my church are seeing this stuff happen. Well, when am I going to find the person who personally has seen it happen? Now, I'm not saying you won't run into them. You'll run into people who will answer that yes, but then you need to interrogate them. Yeah, well, what was the miracle? And why did you think it was a miracle? And what are the facts behind it? And every time that happens, just like in my vineyard weekend example, you find that actually they didn't actually see the miracle. It was only a report of the miracle. And we end up believing this vast sweeping picture of the supernatural happening in the world always on hearsay and never on anybody's direct evidence and direct testimony. Now, I am not resistant to the idea that God works supernaturally. I wouldn't be a Christian if I was. Jesus did all kinds of supernatural things. His apostles did all kinds of supernatural things. The New Testament is full of these supernatural miracles that Jesus and the disciples did. So I'm not anti-supernatural. I believe in it with all of my heart. But given that I have not seen and I have not experienced anything like a miraculous sign that you see in the pages of the New Testament, it's not a foregone conclusion for me that God is doing such a thing today. I'm not going to a priori say God can't do something today because there's some verb in some tense in Corinthians. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me. I'm not saying God can or cannot do the supernatural today. He can do whatever he wants to. And if he wants to do the supernatural, he will do the supernatural, and he's not going to ask my permission. And I understand that. But I need to base my view of reality on my own experience and what I'm seeing and what I know, not on hearsay, it seems to me. And my experience is I don't see a world out there like the world that Jesus and his disciples stepped into and confronted. The supernatural is not operative in the same kind of way. Will it again one day? I think so. I think it's coming, but not now. So I haven't been talking about satanic and demonic activity, but I would argue that exactly everything I've said about the miraculous work of God is also true of the demonic and the satanic. So that's why I made the claim that I did. Okay, we have some time for your comments or questions. It looks like that's going to end our morning, so...
Thanks, Jack. I just had a couple of thoughts as you're talking, and since I happen to be married to someone who tends to listen to and watch things that talk about possible weird things happening or miraculous or whatever, I've kind of reached a point where I can take apart. It's because of our technology and the media and everything, the way something can be done. I understand this really well now, even though I tend to get taken into something that shows, I mean, someone could be making a documentary of you this morning, and because of the camera angles and the music and the way, and the certain voice who explains this, it could all be geared to say whatever they wanted to, like this man is of the devil or whatever, you know. It could be really convincing to some people. Mm-hmm. And you're just standing up there giving a straightforward talk. So I really can see how that can happen. The other thought is, just from my own experience in worldview changes and stuff, I think, and maybe this is totally obvious to everyone, but, and maybe it's what you said, but I think it's really the reason that, like your friend with the vineyard experience and everything, one part of that reasoning is that the worldview is, it's what I learned, that if you're a Christian, you believe that this, it's always been this way since the time of Christ, that is just how everything has operated. And like you say, it's really hard for a non-Christian to accept that because they're not looking for it, but we're looking for. I mean, it says in the Bible there was demons, there were miracles, and so of course it should be this way. And there's nothing else presented as a viable option or even thought about, I don't think. Because for me at least, until I came to this church and got the, you know, it was just presented what seemed a viable option to me, that there were miracles done around the time of the Exodus, there were miracles done around the time of Jesus, and that pointed to what God was doing. If that was taught to me earlier, I missed it totally. And and so now there's this viable option. It could be proven wrong, but to me that just makes the most sense. So I've appreciated that.
Yeah, great. Yeah, and add during the time of Elijah. But it is striking because you do get the impression that the Bible is just shot through with God working supernaturally, but actually it comes in clusters in history. Moses, Elijah, Jesus, and the apostles, with vast centuries in between where God seems utterly invisible to people. That's not abnormal, that's normal.
This isn't about the supernatural, it's about the heaven.
Okay.
Because I hadn't heard that before when you said it's a Greek construct. But then as it goes down in the passage, I mean, he says, rejoice that your names are recorded in heaven.
Right.
And I can see a Lord of heaven and earth that he might be just, you know, Lord of everything. But would you explain that a little bit more? Because, just explain what you mean by that. And if our names are recorded in heaven, is that the same? Is he switching there? Is that a different kind of thing that he's talking about there than he is when he's talking about Satan falling from heaven? And
okay, let me give it a try, and if I don't get to the heart of your question, come back at me. But yeah, I think it's a pagan concept, but it gets appropriated by the Christians, by the Jews and the Christians, because given this pagan concept that there's a realm where those abide who rule the world, well, then who's the only one in that place in the heavens? Well, God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There are no other gods. So they can describe of God being in heaven as a way of describing that he's in control. He's sovereignly controlling all of reality. So when Jesus says, don't lay up treasures for yourself on earth where rust and moth can destroy and thieves can break in and steal or something like that, but lay up treasures for yourself in heaven where those things can't happen. Well, notice even in the Greeks, what was heaven? It was the place where there was no corruption. It was the place of the gods. And what distinguished the gods from this earth is this earth is corruptible. It decays, but the abode of the gods does not. Well, the Christians recognize, well, that's true of our God. That's true of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's eternal. He's incorruptible. So if my treasures are laid up in heaven, in the realm of the incorruptible, he's saying you are defining your existence and defining your life and placing your hope in something that's never going to go away, that will always be there to satisfy you and be valuable to you. If you define your life by the stuff of this earth, it's going to evaporate on you. And as John puts it in 1 John, the world is passing away, and anyone who loves the world will pass away with it. So that's why we need to have our treasures in heaven. So let's see. Go ahead.
Well, the concept, though, I mean of the of that that's not corruptible and God and eternity, I mean, the concept would have to be there. So did not the Jews have a word that would describe that they would take, that it's confusing to me that they would then take a concept, a pagan construct, for something that exists in reality, or that is a real thing that there should be a word for? Or are you saying that that is the word that existed for it?
I think that's what I'm saying, is that that's the word that existed for it. Now, they will conceive of heaven differently than the pagans, because the pagans see the heavens as the abode of the gods, plural, and the Jews are not going to see it as the abode of the gods, plural. It's the abode of the only God that counts. But I think what I'm saying is it's just the, given the development of the language, that was the word for that concept. But, so why am I pointing out that it's a pagan concept? Because it's not our concept. See, thousands of years later, we have a Christianized concept of heaven. We literally think of it as a place. I don't mean we do, but folk Christianity sees heaven as a place. You know, when your doggy dies, your doggy goes to heaven. Or that there's this place where we go that we will be with God, and we will be, and then we describe the nature of that place. But we literally see it as an entirely different place. Well, notice that that's utterly unbiblical. We're never going to go to heaven. To go to heaven would have to be, you'd have to become the ontological peer of God himself. You'd have to become transcendent like God himself. We're not going to go to heaven. We're going to go to the new age, where there will be a new heavens and a new earth. Heavens is just skies. Where there will be a new cosmos and a new earth, a recreated, reestablished something like now, only in a glorified form. Paul argues in Romans 8 that the nature itself groans with anxious longing, waiting for its freedom from corruption to enter into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. When we enter into glory, all of creation is going to enter into glory with it. Well, that's where we're going to go. That's where we're going to live, not in heaven. You see what I'm saying? Because that's to misunderstand what heaven is in the Bible.
Well, I think that answers it better. If you were using it, referring to it as a pagan construct in contrast to our modern Christian concept, then I can understand.
Yeah, that's better, a better way to put it.
One question to follow up on that. So when Elijah was taken up, he was taken up into the heavens. So
I think that's the skies. That's to simply describe that he went up into the atmosphere, and who knows from there. I mean,
Well, it seems like most of us, when we use that term, though, you can, depends on the definition. I mean, we can use words any way we want that sometimes are maybe not biblical, but when we say we're going to heaven, it's still entering the place of glory.
Yeah,
that's what you would
and that's probably what most of us usually mean. It's just a placeholder for the place that you go after you die, and that's fine. I mean, I don't have any objection with that. I'm just saying, if we want to be clear on the nature of what our destiny lies, it's not a ethereal existence on clouds with harps in the sky.
Well, the main question I want to ask you is, it seems like God does work supernaturally, and you would agree with it, I'm sure, too. Just in terms of bringing us to him. I mean, we don't come to God by our brains.
Absolutely.
And how would you define that then? I mean, because it seems like you've kind of precluded.
Good question. Yeah, I'm not saying that God doesn't work supernaturally today, because you're right. Every one of us, the fact that any of us confess Jesus as Lord is a supernatural miracle. So God is very active supernaturally. But that's not a sign. I'm making the distinction between God operating supernaturally and operating supernaturally in such a way that it would qualify, as John describes the things that Jesus did, as signs. They're attention-grabbing because they are so extraordinary and so inexplicable, apart from the notion that God has stepped into history and acted, that there's no way you can rationally miss the fact that God is there and God has purposed something and he's acted to say something to us.
Difference in terms of what's kind of a physically oriented event versus one that's sort of prompted in our heart or spirit or soul.
Right.
Because there's times we feel like we should talk to someone or do something for somebody, and it turned out that was really important at that point in time. And
right.
There's little things like that that you can't say, well, that's a miracle, but that's maybe just a leading of the spirit at some level.
And even physically. Even if God were to answer someone's prayer and intervene to mysteriously and inexplicably heal them, for example, it may very well be supernatural, but it's still not a sign, because it wasn't done in the context and in such a way that it was sending any message from God to mankind about that. It was just an act of compassion and mercy on God's part, rather than actually a meaningful statement about who Jesus is, or who an apostle is, or even who God is. I mean, notice that all the signs in the Gospels are saying something to people. They're saying, this dude is my son, the Messiah, or this apostle knows what he's talking about, listen to him. And even beyond that, there may be a symbolic dimension to the actual thing that happened that is saying something pedagogically about God's purposes. I mean, for example, giving people, healing blind people so that they can see, is in a sense a kind of parable for the kind of supernatural that has happened to us today. We were spiritually blind, and God made it so that we could see. So I think you can look at the signs and recognize that God is doing at different layers a number of different things in them, but they are a way of God speaking to mankind. It's more than just God having compassion. And there, I have no question but what God, in his mercy and his compassion, reaches into our individual lives at times and does really remarkable things that it's not unreasonable for us to say, you know, I just think he healed me. I don't have any problem with that at all. But that's very different than me being a faith healer and claiming that I have the gift and I have the authority and I have the power to bring God's power, mercy and grace to bear on you and heal you. That's about me more often than not. That's not about God.
My concern is, like, when you're talking about how we read about demons in the Bible, and that doesn't match up with our experience today, so things must be different today. It just sounds kind of like a cop-out. I mean, if I heard about some other religion that believed in the abominable snowman, I said, well, how come we can't find the abominable snowman? They said, well, he's dead now. I mean, how is that not just a cop-out?
Well, okay. But if I did read about a religion that believed in the abominable snowman and I couldn't find it, I would want to be critical. I would want to be skeptical. It would be different if, I mean, I think that's a valid response to and criticism of those brands of Christianity that are based on the supernatural being at the essence of our faith. But see, what I'm arguing is I don't think that is at the essence of our faith. It's not the heart and core of the gospel that Jesus comes into the world and does supernatural things. If it was, then for me to just come up with a reason for, based on my experience, for why it's not still happening would be a rationalization. But that's not a claim that I'm making, and it's not a claim I think that the New Testament is making, that this needs to be going on today because this is, after all, what our faith is all about.
Jack, kind of continuing off of Nikki's thing, I have a twofold question. Okay. You seem to be addressing a communication problem with your statement about how you enjoy reads. I'm assuming his essays, inquiries and essays, and so forth. And I guess the problem I see with Reed and his, I guess, assumptions about communication is one that Hugo van Hausman's Thal addressed in his novel, Lord Chandos' Letters, where we have a problem of communicate, that there's just such a breach in communication. How can we ever possibly successfully communicate and through communication come at truth or come at these assumptions? Because, I mean, we're just really honestly going off hearsay. Yes, the child may be being told to the, but the mother may be telling the child to the best of her ability what she perceives as true. But in reality, that's probably not even close to the truth. So could you explain why you think Reed is even remotely close to the truth, or can even achieve truth through this kind of dialogue? And then the second question I have is just from – you used a lot of examples today. And how can – just using your own examples on you, how can I know that these examples
– Happened.
Happened? How can I even just – I just see the whole thing of doubt and that dialogue, and just that we have to just take somebody's belief but at the same time be critical as just being a very confusing point of philosophy.
Let me take the second one first. That's an excellent question. That's why it's absolutely crucial. I mean, that's why lying is so vicious. I mean, it is an evil, evil thing. And I have felt the temptation when I'm teaching to exaggerate, to make my example more compelling than it actually was. And I dare say I have probably succumbed to that at times. So that's a very, very valid question. But it makes it all the more important in the end that we know the character of the person reporting and what their agenda might be. That is not being too skeptical. I think that's what we have to do in the world in which we live. is that do we need to assess the integrity and the honesty of the person giving the report? Are they likely to be lying to me? Are they likely to be just making something up? And even if I'm not making it up whole hog, making up details that make it seem more compelling than it is. And you just, ultimately, we need to trust the people. And they better be trustworthy, and we need to assess how trustworthy they are.
That really drives my question. I don't understand how the intention, like I said, may be good and may be trustworthy in and of itself. But how can we ever arrive to truth, honestly? I don't see how we in ourselves can't. There's just this break between me and other humans. And that's why I feel like we need, going back to the original question, that's why I feel like the intention may be okay.
Well, Reed is not saying, there's several things here. Reed is not saying that my mind is infallible. Reed is not saying that human rationality always and only leads you to truth and never brings you to error. It does. It just, I mean, we know that. We just know that from our own experience. I've believed a lot of really even silly things in my life. And I wasn't less intelligent back then. I was just less experienced. And had different evidence to go on and different experiences to go on that made plausible something that shouldn't have been plausible to me. So it's not infallible. And the other thing he's saying is the principle of credulity is a principle at work, but it's not the only principle at work. And that's where I, gullibility is only relying upon my knee-jerk response of believing people. And relying upon that and that alone. Oh, if you say so, then it's true. Without learning through experience to be appropriately skeptical and appropriately critical at the appropriate times. And that is a skill that we learn over the course of our lives. We need to learn to read character, learn to know who's trustworthy and who's not, learn to know in what context Jack is trustworthy and in what context he may not be trustworthy. I mean, it's not even as simple as a person being trustworthy or not. You know, if I have an agenda, and you know I have an agenda, I'm less likely to be trustworthy in what I say about that, right? So we just need to learn to assess people, circumstances, occasions, the dynamics and realities there at work, sociologically and intrapersonally. That could explain why I'm hearing what I'm hearing and take all that into account.
We also live in an ambivalence of, would you say then that to be good, that being gullible is good and that...
No, being gullible is not good. Being gullible is being infantile. It's being inexperienced. It's living at the beginning level of just believing everything that we hear without having learned through experience to be appropriately skeptical and critical. Okay, I've kept you way over. I'll be glad to interact with more of you afterwards if you want to. I'll let you go. Thanks.